So I would like to provide the audience with a trigger warning. The following interview may be sensitive for some listeners and contain the conversation around sexual violence. Hello, my name is Yolissa Richardson, and today we are interviewing Luz Marquez for The Crowned, an exploration of mental health and prison injustice within the context of systematic racism. May you begin with telling us who you are and your story.
Sure, and I'm so happy to be here. My story begins, like many other survivors, when I was 7 years old, between the ages of 7 and 14. I am born and raised in Harlem. My parents are both migrants from Puerto Rico. I am a first generation Black Puerto Rican. And at the age of 7, was experiencing sexual harm at the hands of my oldest brother, who is 7 years older than me. By the time I'm 12, my mother's boyfriend molested me. And then by the time I'm 14 or 15, I could never remember how old, I was raped by a family friend. And like many who've experienced this, and if you're listening to my voice, there are rape crisis centers across every corner in this country, including Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and Northern Mariana Islands. And there's also culturally specific programs that are all here to support people like me who've experienced such harm, as well as people who are harm doers, need help in gaining control over how they respond to children or women or other people. So much of my work has been healing as well as working to end sexual violence. Most people call it the Me Too movement. And while Tarana Burke is a friend, my shout out to you, T, if you're listening, I've been doing this since I was 26 years old, and I started at the age of 27.
For the listening audience, I would like to provide statistics found within my research on this topic. According to the nonprofit Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, 1 in 9 girls and 1 in 53 boys under the age of 18 experienced sexual abuse or assault at the hands of an adult. Also, according to the ageofconsent.net, statistics show the child abuse rates in the United States as of 2019, child abuse rates of children of Hispanic origin was at 8.1, indicating 8.1 out of 1,000 Hispanic children in the U.S. suffer from some sort of abuse, and African Americans with the rate of 13.8 out of 1,000. Based off of those statistics, what are signs parents should look out for that suggest their child may be experiencing sexual violence?
Sure. Before I answer your question, I think it's important, and I wouldn't be loose because much of my work has been leading the efforts to end sexual violence and child sexual abuse in and amongst our communities of color. And so while the RAIN hotline and all of those faces that you got those stats from are amazing and do amazing work, many of them struggle to provide services to people who were like me, Black Latinos or Black Americans, Africans, immigrants, Black immigrants, Asian communities, Indigenous communities. And so there's a breadth of an amazing movement of leaders across the nation, like Black Women's Blueprint. My shout out to folks in Brooklyn, Amira Youssef out in Iowa, doing amazing work with the Asian community and Pacific Islanders from across the U.S. as well as in the Pacific Territories. Minnesota has a strong Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition. We have some in upstate New York. And so just really wanting to give space to that. And of course, Casa de Esperanza out in Minneapolis, who serves as a Latino hub of resources. And so many of these places, and if you are listening, you get a chance, check them out. Look them up. They have Facebook. They have websites. They have them in their indigenous languages as well as in English. And they would answer your question by saying that the primary thing that needs to happen with any good prevention is to get the community engaged, the very community that is impacted by this. And so myself as a survivor leader, many of us are lifting our voices to speak about the horrors of what happened to us and how parents could be better equipped. Ignacio Rivera, who's a really close friend of mine, who also does and is a survivor of child sexual abuse, does a lot of work with parents, educating them around issues of consent, starting at the age of 1, starting from the day that you bring your child home and you're changing their diapers. I tell parents all the time, when we have children, everybody wants to change the diaper. And I'm like, you could start to begin to set a boundary at that age where you're teaching not just your child, but everybody around you that there's certain things that everybody doesn't have to be a part of, you know? And so when my kids were little, I would wash them and I would sing to them and say to them, I'm washing you now. And at some point you will wash yourself and no one else will. Helping them to gain that language that I didn't get and that no one told me about. And then the other part of this is, how much can we put on kids to protect themselves? And that really the onus is on the adults around them, all adults, not just parents, teachers, you know, coaches, community spaces that are working with youth in the summer to really get them to have a voice. Unfortunately, child sexual abuse is an epidemic. There's 14 million of us across the country in the U.S. It is bigger than COVID. And yet we don't spend enough time talking about it and putting resources right in the hands, especially of Black and Latino and Asian and Indigenous communities. So I hope I answered your question, but I hope that folks listening will go out of those very normative mainstream organizations like RAIN, who just barely got English, Spanish language as a hotline that has been funded for years by MTV and wouldn't do a Spanish hotline back in the 90s when I was telling them you needed to diversify language access. No, so now we got our own hotlines and people could call in their own language and get someone on the other line that could speak that language and help support them.
Now, our next question, you kind of covered it, but I love the way that you explain and break it down for people to understand. What is consent?
Well, consent is a big thing, right? And I think for me, and I've learned this most from working with young people, is that consent is bigger than just saying yes. It also means saying no in more ways than one. Some people, I remember when I think back to when I was 14 or 15 and I was raped by this guy who I can never remember how old I am, but I had a crush on him and he was like 19, maybe 20. I'm not sure. And I had a crush on him. You know, no one ever said to me that I couldn't say no to someone who was older. But even if I couldn't get the words out, because I froze, I couldn't fight back, I couldn't even speak when I was trying to yell. It was just like air coming out, and I couldn't like move. I thought I was moving and I thought I was screaming, but there was nothing. And so using nonverbals and using body language to also allow people to understand that that too is part of consent. And so that silence never means that you're okay. But if we start telling that to kids and only wrap it around sex, then we lose them as an audience. What if we use that same issue of consent when we're working with kids, young people, as young as two, and it is centered around everything that you engage in them so that they already instinctively grow up with a sense of autonomy, right? And so for me, consent is the big one. I know you're getting ready to go to college. There's a lot of folks going to college. Part of orientation is mandated. I was part of a movement that made that a mandated, that every incoming freshman would get an orientation and consent being the big thing. And what I hope that schools and RAs and folks are really going past is bigger than just consent only pertains to sex. Because if we start there, then it's hard to really engage. We should start from everything. What did it take for you to prepare for today with a mentor like Sina? And did you consent on all of those things? Do you get it?
Yes.
And if we start on those basic things, then when it gets real complicated, it makes it a lot easier because you would have already had practice. You already would have had some conditioning, and the world, more importantly, would have had conditioning around it.
Now, some states, including New York State, have the close-in age exemption, which allowed a person under the age of consent to engage in sexual intercourse with an older partner that is within 4 years older of a minor. What are your thoughts on the age of consent? Do you think it should be higher?
It's complicated, right? We just talked about consent and I just gave like a really abstract theoretical opinion around even a child as young as one being able to give consent to something, right? And so a child when they're one, they're like consenting probably around where they leave their poop at, right? And where they don't, because they're so young, right? So it's like these little simple things, but it gets complicated, right? We never talk about power dynamics that we have as young people with our parents, with older siblings, with our teachers. And so the reason that there's these ages of consent is because there's a power dynamic that happens, as well as there's about mental capacity, right? We teach young people how to drive. We teach young people how to cook. We teach them how to clean the bed. And we never talk to them about one of the most intimate and complicated life functions that everybody should have a right to engage in, right? And so we say in the sexual assault world, we're not against sex, we're against non-consensual sex. And so the way that we can improve sexual relations is to begin to talk about that in the same way that we talk about put your seatbelt on, or with COVID, put your mask on, right? And so in that same way, we should be able to talk about sexual autonomy, age, and capacity. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're 7, if you're 14 and you're dating like a 19, 20 year old, what do you all have in common? What is that relationship based on? And is it her fault? Or is, you know, and I don't want to just say her anymore, because I think the whole queer movement is moving us around gender normatives and pushing us right past that. And I'm learning that as I'm going too. And so what does it mean for a little boy who's like 15 and all of a sudden he's like, you know, I had sex with a 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. Well, how do we know he consented to that? Mm-hmm. Right? And there's something about society that allows him to talk about it and boast about it like he's big and bad. And then if a girl does it, then she's a slut or a thot or whatever right. The latest word is, right, for mm-hmm. young girls. And so I think all of that is very, very complicated. And here's the thing. Most child sexual abuse that occurs is with sometimes sibling to sibling. And there's no 4-year-old difference, you know? In my story, there was, but sometimes there isn't. You know, I know of some stories where folks were twins. And then the issue around consent and age, it also makes people with disabilities vulnerable mm-hmm. because it doesn't take into capacity what is a person with a disability who has a cognitive disability or developmental disability, and when do they get onus around sexuality and their body. And so it's really, really complicated. As a person who spent 15 years in Congress, lobbying Congress, working with the White House, I realized that we're not going to end this issue by just legislating laws and bills. It's got to be a cultural, normative sort of interruption and disruption for us to get there.
What do you wish your community provided you with during your experience? Talking about like safe spaces, resources of support?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question, because I actually got to dream out. A lot of us watch probably, you know, Marissa Hardatek and the sex crime show, and we see in an hour the victim gets justice because they go to the criminal justice system, somebody gets apprehended, yada, yada, right? It's never that neat. I was a survivor who didn't access the criminal justice system, and I don't regret that. But I am a survivor who focused on healing, and that I am so blessed. And that just came from within. It wasn't like I was special or anything. I think it's a normal thing for us in our bodies. Our bodies are amazing and will heal itself or help us to reach for what healing looks like. And so from 2003 to 2012, I was fortunate to organizing the first national women of color anti-sexual assault organization known as CISA, Sisters of Color Ending Sexual Assault, which still exists till today. And I'm honored to be part of that legacy. I became the policy person. And so the Violence Against Women Act was up for reauthorization. It's up for reauthorization every 5 years. It's very much like the Americans with Disability Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. And so the Violence Against Women Act was up. And this is the act that funds RAIN and all of these rape crisis centers and police stations and courthouses and Department of Justice. And there's no funding that's specifically for communities of color. So for a good portion of my work on the Hill in Congress and signed by Obama, which I was fortunate to see, was to ensure that culturally specific programs would be funded. So in other words, we have a strong network of rape crisis centers. They exist across the country. We in New York have over 80 of them. We have domestic violence shelters. But many of those shelters, like many movements, struggle with racism, struggle with homophobia, struggle with ableism. And so I do my work at those intersections, right? And so for me, when I was experiencing this, I grew up in Harlem. It's like the most diverse community, the most rich in terms of culture. Like, there shouldn't have been a reason why at the age of 12, someone didn't flag what was happening to me, interrupt it, and provide me with support. There should have been information in Spanish that educated my mom, that went to my church, that came to my hood, that spoke to us, but there wasn't. And the reason there wasn't is because most of those monies do not go to people of color organizations. And so what I was able to do in Congress for the very first time in the history of the Violence Against Women Act, and they debated this on the floor of the Capitol, was what does it look like to protect Black women, Latina women, Asian women, Indigenous women? What does that look like? And how do we fund those organizations? And so we now have culturally specific programs across the country, in Puerto Rico, in Guam, in American Samoa, Northern Mariana Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands. And it's all to the little 12-year-old in me that was saying, there's no way in hell this could happen to anybody else. And so how could I do this? And so for us in Troy, New York, the only one who gets that funding is In Our Own Voices. It's an LGBT, people of color-led organization that works to combat child sexual abuse, sexual violence, and domestic violence. They do amazing work. They have a hotline. They speak English and Spanish. They do advocacy, and they will do hospital company for the rape exam and support folks. Yeah.
What has been your experience with movement building around sexual violence and survivorship? How can others support these organizing efforts?
Well, I think the biggest thing is thinking out of the box, right? So like if we know there's HBCUs, we know that there's Black media, we know there's Asian media, then we must know that there's also advocates that represent our communities that are doing this work and is supporting them, right? Finding out who they are and giving them support, like In Our Own Voices, like Black Women's Blueprint, like Dawa Farm, that's a Haitian program in Brooklyn, or Satu Yetu, that's a African program in the Bronx, and providing them support and services. The other thing is, as a survivor, about from 2016 to 2019, I was part of the first cohort ever in the U.S. that funded, through the Ms. Foundation and Warren Buffett's Nova Foundation, a survivor leadership cohort called Just Beginnings Collaborative. And that is really where I saw the power of our voices that went beyond just the legislative day and really was about how do we grow our movement. And so from 2016 to 2019, as a Black Latina, I began to hold spaces at Howard University, which is a historically Black college in D.C., focused on survivor leadership specifically for those of us who are Black Latinas. And so if anybody wants to check it out, we did it every July 25th. That was just last week, which is the International Day of Black Latinas. And I used it as a way to talk about an issue that we never talk about, which is child sexual abuse and sexual violence. And it was really amazing to see people come out. And we did listening circles. I was able to publish the first ever research on Afro-Latinas and child sexual abuse. It goes all the way back to enslavement and the colonization of my homeland of Puerto Rico and the enslavement of Black Africans that were brought into Puerto Rico and the breedings. So in essence, we're talking right now here about incest and what I experienced in my house, but we also have a strong legacy, unfortunately, around the true impact of slavery in this country, and it's rooted in child sexual abuse and breeding.
Now, what is justice and healing to you? Are there different forms of justice and healing for survivors?
Yes, and thank you for asking that. I started off saying that I got justice when I was able to help create the culturally specific program in the Violence Against Women Act. And that really was it, but it's deeper than that. I started my healing with a healing therapist at the age of 26. I have a different therapist now. If I don't do anything, I definitely do my time with my therapist. It's like the gift that I give to the little girl in me. I use rituals that are all part of African traditions, anything from sage to Palo Santo to Florida water, because aromas help me. Aromas are a trigger for me, meaning I could be having a perfect day and all of a sudden smell something that reminds me of one of the people that abused me and it'll take me back. Early, I was giving somebody a tour and they yelled and it just took me and I just needed a moment to like, you know, grapple myself because I live with PTSD every day. Mm. And so for me, healing has been around how do I get control over my life, even if I'm 54. When I was 26 and 30, I was angry that I would have to work on healing for the rest of my life. I think now I finally realize I wouldn't live it any other way. That's what I have to do. That's what I have to do to be the best wife, the best mom, the best community organizer, the best version of who I am. I owe it to myself to focus on healing. And that there is no way I would have got healing by sending my brother to prison, my mother's boyfriend at that time to prison. He got community. That was the only one I disclosed, by the way. And he got what we call in the hood community accountability. I wouldn't have wanted him to get beat up like that. None of that would have given it to me. It was me walking through a very dark journey of blame, of shame, of deep hatred. You know? So healing is every day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you have any closing statements and thoughts? Any topics we did not cover that you would like to speak on?
I think one of the things that I would love, if I could narrow this down, it would be that we have to stop blaming girls. We have to stop blaming little girls for what happens to them. We have to stop calling them fast. We have to stop shaming them for what they wear or what the body types they have. We have to end this anti-blackness thing that we have amongst ourselves, that we don't see black girls or black Latinas like me as ever being possibly victimized by anyone. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so that has to be a reckoning within our own community. And so as I do work in Troy around Black Lives Matter, my work is infused by ending sexual violence and knowing that it's not going to end by law enforcement. It's only going to end. Any violent crime is only going to end by the very people who've experienced it and the people who are doing the harm. And working at that very messy, complicated space, because that's the only way we're going to end violence, you know?
I want to thank you for being here to share your story. It is not easy to get up here and speak about such a gruesome experience and details. And for any of my listeners, the local hotline for sexual assault and crime victims assistance program for Rensselaer County is reached at 518-271-3257. Again, 518-271-3257. 3257.